time, it hadn't hurt. His feet had struck the ground and he waked. But waked without the choking or the burning, stabbing sensations that left him gasping and gritting his teeth. He glanced across. Yes, Buck was still there, huddled up under the ragged plaid he'd bought from Cumberpatch. Wise purchase. He lay back down on his side, hauling the canvas up to shield his face while still allowing him to breathe. He'd admit to a feeling of relief at seeing Buck. He'd half expected the man to decamp and head straight back to Castle Leoch after hearing the truth about his own family. Though, in justice to Buck, he wasn't a sneak. If he'd made up his mind to do that, he'd likely say so, after punching Roger in the nose for not telling him sooner. As it was, he'd been there, staring into the ashes of the fire when Roger came back. He hadn't looked up, and Roger hadn't said anything to him, but had sat down and taken out needle and thread to mend a rip in the seam of his coat. After a bit, though, Buck had stirred himself. "Why wait to tell me now?" he asked quietly. His voice held no particular note of accusation. "Why not tell me while we were still near Leoch and Cranesmuir?"
"I hadn't made up my mind to tell you at all," Roger had said bluntly. "It was just thinking about, well, about what we're doing and what might happen. I thought of a sudden that maybe you should know. And,"
he hesitated for a moment,
"I didn't plan it, but it's maybe better so. You'll have time to think, maybe, whether you want to find your parents before we go back."
Buck had merely grunted in reply to that and said no more. But it wasn't Buck's response that was occupying Roger's mind at the moment. It hadn't hurt when he'd cleared his throat while talking to Buck, though he hadn't noticed consciously at the time. McEwen. Was it what he'd done? His touch? Roger wished he'd been able to see whether McEwen's hand shed blue light when he'd touched Roger's damaged throat. What about that light? He thought that Claire had mentioned something like that once. Oh, yes. Describing how Master Raymond had healed her following the miscarriage she'd had in Paris. Seeing her bones glow blue inside her body was how she'd put it, he thought. Now that was a staggering thought. Was it a familial trait, common to time travellers? He yawned hugely and swallowed once more, experimentally. No pain. He couldn't keep track of his thoughts any longer. Felt sleep spreading through his body like good whiskey, warming him. And let go, finally, wondering what he might say to his father, if... Chapter 97 A Man to Do a Man's Job. Boston, Massachusetts, December the 8th, 1980. Gail Abernathy provided a quick but solid supper of spaghetti with meatballs, salad, garlic bread, and, after a quick penetrating look at Bree, a bottle of wine, despite Brianna's protests. "You're spending the night here," Gail said in a tone brooking no opposition and pointed at the bottle, "and you're drinking that. I don't know what you've been doing to yourself, girl, and you don't need to tell me, but you need to stop doing it."
"I wish I could."
But her heart had risen the moment she walked through the familiar door, and her sense of agitation did subside, though it was far from disappearing. The wine helped, though. The Abernathys helped more. Just the sense of being with friends, of not being alone with the kids, and the fear and uncertainty. She went from wanting to cry to wanting to laugh and back again in the space of seconds, and felt that if Gail and Joe had not been there, she might have had no choice but to go into the bathroom, turn on the shower, and scream into a folded bath towel, her only safety valve in the last few days. But now there was at least someone to talk to. She didn't know whether Joe could offer anything beyond a sympathetic ear, but at the moment, that was worth more to her than anything. Conversation over dinner was light and kid-oriented, Gail asking Mandy whether she liked Barbies and whether her Barbie had a car, and Joe talking soccer versus baseball. Jem was a hardcore Red Sox fan, being allowed to stay up to ungodly hours to listen to rare radio broadcasts with his mother. Brianna contributed nothing more than the occasional smile, and felt the tension slowly leave her neck and shoulders. It came back, though, with less force when dinner was over and Mandy, half asleep with her arm in her plate, was carried off to bed by Gail, humming, "Jesu, joy of man's desiring," in a voice like a cello. Bree rose to pick up the dirty plates, but Joe waved her back, rising from his chair. "Leave them, darling. Come and talk to me in the den. Bring the rest of the wine," he added, then smiled at Jem. "Jem, why don't you go up and ask Gail, can you watch TV in the bedroom?" Jem had a smudge of spaghetti sauce at the corner of his mouth, and his hair was sticking up on one side in porcupine spikes. He was a little pale from the journey, but the food had restored him, and his eyes were bright, alert.
"No, sir,"
he said respectfully, and pushed back his own chair.
"I'll stay with my ma'am."
"You don't need to do that, honey," she said. "Uncle Joe and I have grown-up things we need to talk about. You..."
"I'm staying."
She gave him a hard look, but recognized instantly, with a combination of horror and fascination, a Fraser male with his mind made up. His lower lip was trembling, just a little. He shut his mouth hard to stop it, and looked soberly from her to Joe and back.
"Dad's not here," he said, and swallowed. "And neither is Granda. I'm staying."
She couldn't speak. Joe nodded, though, as soberly as Jem, took a can of Coke from the refrigerator, and led the way to the den. She followed them, clutching the wine bottle and two glasses.
"Bree, darling."
Joe turned back for a moment.
"Get another bottle from the cupboard over the stove. This is going to take some talking."
It did. Jemmy was on his second Coke. The question of his going to bed, let alone to sleep, was clearly academic. And the second bottle of wine was one-third down before she'd finished, describing the situation, all the situations, and what she thought of doing about them.
"Okay," Joe said quite casually. "I don't believe I'm saying this, but you need to decide whether to go through some rocks in North Carolina or in Scotland and end up in the 18th century either way. Is that it?"
"That's most of it." She took a swallow of wine. It seemed to steady her. "But that's the first thing, yes. See, I know where Mama and Dad were at the end of 1778, and that's the year we'd go back to, if everything works the way it seems to have worked before. They'd either be back on Fraser's Ridge or on their way there." Jem's face lightened a little at that, but he didn't say anything. She met his eyes directly. "I was going to take you and Mandy through the stones on Ocracoke, where we came through before. You remember? On the island."
"Vroom,"
he said very softly, and broke into a sudden grin, reliving his first exposure to automobiles.
"Yes,"
she said, smiling in spite of herself. "Then we could go to the ridge, and I was going to leave you with Granny and Grandad while I went to Scotland to find Daddy." Jem's smile faded, and his red brows drew together.
"Pardon my pointing out the obvious," Joe said, "but wasn't there a war going on in 1778?
"There was," she said tersely, "and yes, it might be a little difficult to get a ship from North Carolina to Scotland. But believe you me, I could do it."
"Oh, I do," he assured her. "It would be easier and safer, I reckon, than going through Scotland and searching for Roger with Jem and Mandy to look after at the same time, but..."
"I don't need looking after."
"Maybe not," Joe told him. "But you've got about 6 years, 60 pounds, and another 2 feet to grow before you can look after your mama. Till you get big enough that nobody can just pick you up and carry you off. She's got to worry about you."
Jem looked as if he wanted to argue the point, but he was at the age where logic did sometimes prevail, and happily, this was one of those times. He made a small mm-hmm sound in his throat, which startled Bree, and sat back on the ottoman, still frowning.
"But you can't go where Granny and Grandad are," he pointed out, "'cause Dad's not where... I mean, when, you thought? He's not in the same time they are."
"Bingo," she said briefly, and reaching into the pocket of her sweater, carefully withdrew the plastic bag protecting Roger's letter. She handed it to Joe.
"Read that."
He whipped his reading glasses out of his own pocket and, with them perched on his nose, read the letter carefully, looked up at her, wide-eyed, then bent his head and read it again. After which he sat quite still for several minutes, staring into space, the letter open on his knee. At last he heaved a sigh, folded the letter carefully, and handed it back to her.
"So now it's space and time," he said. "You ever watch Doctor Who on PBS?"
"All the time," she said dryly, "on the BBC. And don't think I wouldn't sell my soul for a TARDIS."
Jem made the little Scottish noise again, and Brianna looked sideways at him. "Are you doing that on purpose?" He looked up at her, surprised.
"Doing what?"
"Never mind. When you are 15, I'm locking you in the cellar."
"What? Why?"
he demanded indignantly.
"Because that's when your father and grandfather started getting into real trouble, and evidently you're going to be just like them."
"Oh."
He seemed pleased to hear this, and subsided.
"Well, putting aside the possibility of getting hold of a working TARDIS..."
Joe leaned forward, topping up both glasses of wine.
"It's possible to travel farther than you thought, because Roger and this Buck guy just did it. So you think you could do it too?"
"I've got to," she said simply.
"He won't try to come back without Jem, so I have to go find him."
"Do you know how he did it? You told me it took gemstones to do it. Did he have, like, a special kind of gem?"
"No."
She frowned, remembering the effort of using the kitchen shears to snip apart the old brooch with its scatter of chip-like diamonds.
"They each had a few tiny little diamonds, but Roger went through before with a single biggish diamond. He said it was like the other times we know about. It exploded or vaporized or something. Just a smear of soot in his pocket."
"Hmm."
Joe took a sip of wine and held it meditatively in his mouth for a moment before swallowing.
"Hypothesis one, then. Number is more important than size. For example, you can go farther if you have more stones in your pocket."
She stared at him for a moment, somewhat taken aback.
"I hadn't thought of that," she said slowly. "The first time he tried it, though, he had his mother's locket that had garnets on it. Definitely garnets. Plural. But he didn't get through. He was thrown back. On fire."
She shuddered briefly, the sudden vision of Mandy flung on the ground, burning. She gulped wine and coughed.
So we don't know whether he might have gone farther if he had gone through."
"It's just a thought," Joe said mildly, watching her. "Now, Roger's mentioning Jeremiah here, and it sounds like he means there's somebody besides Jemmy who's got that name. Do you know what he means?"
"I do."
A skitter of something between fear and excitement ran down her back with icy little feet, and she took another swallow of wine and a deep breath before telling him about Jerry Mackenzie, the circumstances of his disappearance, and what her mother had told Roger.
"She thought he was very likely an accidental traveller, one who couldn't get back."
She took another quick sip.
"That's my other grandad?" Jemmy asked.
His face flushed a little at the thought, and he sat forward, hands clutched between his thighs.
"If we go where Dad is, will we get to meet him too?"
"I can't even think about that," she told him honestly, though the suggestion made her insides curl up.
Among the million alarming contingencies of the current situation, the possibility of meeting her deceased father-in-law face to face was about 999,999th on the list of things to be worried about. But apparently it was on the list.
But what did Roger mean about seeking Jeremiah? Joe asked, clinging stubbornly to the point.
We think that's how you steer, Brianna said, focusing your thoughts on a particular person who's in the time you want to go to. We don't know that for sure, though, she added, and stifled a small belch. Each time we, or Mama, did it, it was always 202 years. And it was when Mama went back the first time. Though come to think of it, she added, frowning, she thought it might have been because Black Jack Randall, Daddy's ancestor, was there. He was the first person she met when she came through the stones. She said he looked a lot like Daddy.
Uh-huh.
Joe poured another half glass and stared at it for a moment, as though hypnotized by the soft reddish light glowing in its bowl.
But...
he stopped, marshalling his thoughts.
But other people did go farther. This Gielish your mother mentioned, and Buck.
Did he...
never mind. Roger and Buck did do it this time, for sure. So it's possible. We just don't know how.
I was forgetting, Gielis, Bree said slowly. She'd seen the woman only once, and very briefly. A tall, slender figure, fair hair flying in the wind of a murderous fire, her shadow thrown onto one of the standing stones, enormous, elongated. Now that I think, though, I don't believe she had gemstones when she went back. She thought it took, sacrifice. She glanced at Jem, then looked at Joe, lowering her brows with a meaningful look that said, don't ask. And fire. And she never came back the other way, though she planned to, with stones. And suddenly a penny that she hadn't known was there dropped. She told Mama about using stones, not the other way round. So somebody else, told her. Joe digested that for a moment, but then shook his head, dismissing the distraction.
Okay. Hypothesis two. Focusing your thoughts on a particular person helps you go to where they are. That makes sense to you, Jem? He asked, turning to Jemmy, who nodded.
Sure. If it's somebody you knew.
Okay, then...
Joe stopped abruptly, looking at Jem.
If it's somebody you know?
The icy centipede came rippling up Bree's backbone and into her hair, making her scalp contract. Jem? Her voice sounded odd to her own ears, husky and half breathless. Mandy says she can hear you, in her head. Can you hear her? She swallowed hard, and her voice came clearer. Can you hear Daddy that way? The small red brows drew together in a puzzled frown. Sure. Can't you? The deep line between Uncle Joe's eyebrows hadn't gone away since the night before, Jem saw. He still looked friendly. He nodded at Jem and pushed a cup of hot chocolate across the counter to him. But his eyes kept going back to Mam, and every time they did, the line got deeper. Mam was buttering Mandy's toast. Jem thought she wasn't as worried as she had been, and felt a little better himself. He'd slept all night for the first time in a long time, and he thought maybe Mam had too. No matter how tired he was, he usually woke up every couple of hours listening out for noises, and then listening harder to be sure Mandy and Mam were still breathing. He had nightmares where they weren't.
So, Jem, Uncle Joe said.
He put down his coffee cup and patted his lips with a paper napkin left over from Halloween. It was black with orange jack-o'-lanterns and white ghosts on it.
How far can you, you know, when your sister's not with you?
How far? Jem said uncertainly, and looked at Mam. It hadn't ever occurred to him to wonder.
"If you went in the living room right now," Uncle Joe said, nodding at the door. "Could you tell she was in here, even if you didn't know she was in here?"
"Yeah. I mean, yes, sir. I think so."
He stuck his finger in the hot chocolate, still too hot to drink.
"When I was in the tunnel, in the train, I knew she was somewhere. It's not like science fiction or anything, I mean," he added, trying to explain. "Not like X-rays or phasers or like that. I just..."
He struggled for an explanation and finally jerked his head at Mam, who was staring at him with a serious kind of look that bothered him a little.
"I mean, if you closed your eyes, you'd still know Mam was here, wouldn't you? It's like that."
Mam and Uncle Joe looked at each other.
"Want toast?"
Mandy thrust her half-gnawed bit of buttered toast at him. He took it and had a bite. It was good. Squidgy white bread, not the home-baked brown kind Mam made, with gritty bits in it.
If he could hear her, sense her, from the tunnel while she was at home.
"He can do it for a good long way," Mam said. "But I don't know for sure that she was at home then. I was driving all over with her looking for Jem. And Mandy could sense him while we were in the car that night, but..." Now her eyebrows went together. He didn't like seeing a line there. "She was telling me she was getting colder when we drove toward Inverness. But I don't know if she meant she couldn't hear him at all, or..."
"I don't think I can feel her when I'm at school," Jem said, anxious to be helpful. "But I'm not sure, 'cause I don't think about her at school."
"How far's the school from your place?" Uncle Joe asked. "You want a Pop-Tart, Princess?"
"Yes!"
Mandy's buttery round face lighted up, but Jem glanced at Mam. Mam looked as if she wanted to kick Uncle Joe under the counter for a second. But then she glanced down at Mandy, and her face went all soft. "All right," she said. And Jem felt a fluttery, excited sort of feeling in his middle. Mam was telling Uncle Joe how far the school was, but Jem wasn't paying attention. They were going to do it. They were really going to do it. Because the only reason Mam would let Mandy eat Pop-Tarts without a fuss was because she figured she'd never get to eat another one.
"Can I have one too, Uncle Joe?" he asked. "I like the blueberry ones."
Chapter 98. The Wall. Hadrian's Wall looked very much as Roger recalled it from a long-ago school trip. A huge thing, standing nearly 15 feet high and 8 feet wide, double stone walls filled with rubble in between, winding off into the distance. The people weren't that much different either, at least in terms of speech and livelihood. They raised cattle and goats, and the Northumberland dialect had apparently not developed much since Geoffrey Chaucer's time. Roger and Buck's Highland accents elicited slit-eyed looks of suspicious incomprehension, and they were, for the most part, reduced to basic gestures and sign language in order to obtain food and occasionally shelter. With a bit of trial and error, Roger did work out an approximate Middle English for "hast come here a stranger." From the looks of the place and the looks he and Buck were getting, he would have said the contingency was remote, and so it proved. 3 days of walking and they were still plainly the strangest men anyone near the wall had ever seen.
"Surely a man dressed in RAF uniform would look even more peculiar than we do," he said to Buck.
"He would," Buck replied logically, "if he were still wearing it."
Roger grunted in chagrin. He hadn't thought of the possibility that Jerry might have discarded his uniform on purpose, or been deprived of it by whomever came across him first. It was on the fourth day. The wall itself had rather surprisingly changed, being no longer built of stone and rubble, but of stacked turves, that they met a man wearing Jerry Mackenzie's flight jacket. The man was standing at the edge of a half-ploughed field, staring morosely into the distance apparently with nothing on his mind save his hair.
Roger froze, hand on Buck's arm, compelling him to look.
Jesus,
Buck whispered, grabbing Roger's hand.
I didn't believe it. That's it, isn't it?
He asked, turning to Roger, brows raised.
I mean, the way you described it.
Yes, it is.
Roger felt his throat tighten with excitement and fear. But there was only the one thing to be done, regardless. And dropping Buck's hand, he forged through the dead grass and scattered rock toward the farmer, if that's what he was. The man heard them coming and turned casually, then stiffened, seeing them, and looked wildly round for help.
Yervis,
he shouted, or so Roger thought. Looking over his shoulder, Roger saw the stone walls of a house, evidently built into the wall.
Put up your hands,
Roger said to Buck, throwing up his own, palm out, to show his lack of threat. They advanced slowly, hands up, and the farmer stood his ground, though watching them as though they might explode if they got too close. Roger smiled at the man and elbowed Buck in the ribs to make him do likewise.
Good morn, he said clearly and carefully. Hast coom a stranger here?
He pointed to his own coat and then to the flight jacket. His heart was thumping hard. He wanted to knock the man over and strip it off his back, but that wouldn't do.
Now,
said the man, quickly backing away, holding on to the edges of the jacket.
Begone! We mean you no harm, Dafty,
Buck said, in as conciliating a tone as he could manage. He patted the air in a soothing manner.
Kenst du die Mann? What the bloody hell is that?
Roger asked, out of the side of his mouth.
Ancient Norse. I don't know,
but I heard an Orkney man say it once. It means...
I can tell what it means. Does this look like Orkney to you?
No, but if you can tell what it means, maybe he can too, aye?
Now,
the man repeated, and bellowed,
Yervis,
again. He began to back away from them.
Wait, said Roger, look.
He fumbled quickly in his pocket and withdrew the little oilcloth packet holding his father's identity discs. He pulled them out, dangling them in the chilly breeze.
See? Where's the man who wore these?
The farmer's eyes bulged and he turned and ran clumsily, his clogs hindering him through the clods of the field, shouting,
Yervis, help!
And several other less comprehensible things.
Do we wait for Yervis to turn up?
Buck said, shifting uneasily.
He may not be friendly. Yes, we do,
Roger said firmly. The blood was high in his chest and face, and he flexed his hands nervously.
Close. They were so close.
And yet his spirits went from exhilaration to plunging fear and back within seconds. It hadn't escaped him that there was a strong possibility that Jerry Mackenzie had been killed for that jacket. A possibility that seemed much more likely in view of their interlocutor's precipitate flight. The man had disappeared into a windbreak of small trees, beyond which some sheds were visible.
Perhaps Yervis was a stockman or dairyman?
Then the barking started. Buck turned to look at Roger.
Yervis, you think? Jesus Christ!
A huge, broad-headed, barrel-chested brown dog with a broad, toothy jaw to match came galloping out of the trees and made for them, its proprietor bringing up the rear with a spade. They ran for it, circling the house with Yervis on their heels, baying for blood. The broad green bank of the wall loomed up in front of Roger, and he leapt for it, jamming the toes of his boots into the turf and scrabbling with fingers, knees and elbows, and likely his teeth too. He hurled himself over the top and bounced down the far side, landing with a tooth-rattling thud. He was fighting to draw breath when Buck landed on top of him.
Shit,
his ancestor said briefly, rolling off him.
Come on.
He jerked Roger to his feet, and they ran, hearing the farmer shouting curses at them from the top of the wall. They found refuge in the lee of a crag, a few hundred yards beyond the wall, and collapsed there, gasping.
The Emperor Hadrian. Kent, what the bloody hell he was about.
Roger managed at last. Buck nodded, wiping sweat from his face.
No, very hospitable,
he wheezed. He shook his head and gulped air.
What? Now?
Roger patted the air, indicating the need for oxygen before he could formulate ideas. And they sat quiet for a bit, breathing. Roger tried to be logical about it, though spikes of adrenaline kept interfering with his thought processes. One, Jerry Mackenzie had been here. That was all but certain. It was beyond the bounds of probability that there should be two displaced travellers wearing RAF flight jackets. Two, he wasn't here now. Could that be safely deduced? No, Roger concluded reluctantly. It couldn't. He might have traded the jacket to Eavis's owner for food or something, in which case he'd likely moved on. But if that were the case, why had the farmer not simply said so, rather than setting the dog on them? And if he had stolen the jacket, either Jerry was dead and buried somewhere nearby. That thought made Roger's stomach clench and the hairs prickle on his jaw. Or he'd been assaulted and stripped, but perhaps had escaped. All right. If Jerry was here, he was dead. And if so, the only way of finding out was to subdue the dog and then beat the information out of Yeavis's owner. He didn't feel quite up to that at the moment.
He's not here,
Roger said hoarsely. His breathing was still hard, but regular now. Buck gave him a quick look, but then nodded. There was a long streak of muddy green down his cheek, smeared moss from the wall that echoed the green of his eyes.
Aye, what next then?
The sweat was cooling on Roger's neck. He wiped it absently with the end of the scarf that had somehow made it over the wall with him.
I've got an idea. Given the reaction of our friend there,
he nodded in the direction of the farmstead, invisible beyond the green mass of the wall.
I'm thinking that asking for a stranger might not be the wisest thing. But what about the stones?
Buck blinked at him in incomprehension.
Stones? Aye, standing stones. Jerry did travel. We ken that much. What are the odds he came through a circle? And if so, they're likely none so far away. And folk wouldn't be threatened, I think, by two dafties asking after stones. If we find the place he likely came through, then we can start to cast out from there and ask at the places nearest to the stones. Cautiously.
Buck tapped his fingers on his knee, considering, then nodded.
A standing stone is na like to bite the asses out of our breeks. All right then, let's go.
Chapter 99 Radar Boston, December the 9th, 1980 Jem felt nervous. Mam and Uncle Joe were both trying to act as if everything was okay. But even Mandy could tell something was up. She was squirming around in the back seat of Uncle Joe's Cadillac like she had ants in her pants, pulling up her button sweater over her head so her black curls fluffed out of the neck hole like something boiling over.
Sit still,
he muttered to her, but he didn't expect her to, and she didn't. Uncle Joe was driving, and Mam had a map open in her lap.
What are you doing, Mandy? Mam said absently. She was making marks on the map with a pencil.
Mandy unbuckled her seatbelt and popped up on her knees. She'd pulled her arms out of her sweater so they flopped around, and now just her face was poking out of the neck hole.
I'm an octopus, she said,
and shook herself so the sweater's arms danced. Jem laughed in spite of himself. So did Mam, but she waved Mandy back down. Octopus, she said, and put your seatbelt back on right now. Octo means eight in Latin, she added. Octopuses have eight legs. Or arms, maybe.
You've only got four, Jem said to Mandy.
Does that make her a tetrapus, Mam?
Maybe.
But Mam had gone back to her map. The common, do you think? She said to Uncle Joe. It's a little more than a quarter mile across the longest axis.
and we could go down into the public garden if...
Yeah, good idea. I'll let you and Jem off at Park Street, then drive along Beacon to the end of the common and back round.
It was cold and cloudy, with just a few flakes of snow in the air. He remembered Boston Common, and was kind of glad to see it again, even with the trees leafless and the grass brown and dead. There were still people there. There always were. And their winter hats and scarves looked happy, all different colours. The car stopped on Park Street, across from the tourist trolleys that stopped every 20 minutes. Dad had taken them all on one once. One of the orange ones with the open sides. It had been summer then. Do you have your mittens, sweetheart? Mum was already out on the sidewalk, peering through the window. You stay with Uncle Joe, Mandy, just for a few minutes. Jem got out and stood with Mam on the sidewalk, putting on his mittens while they watched the grey caddy pull away. "Close your eyes, Jem," Mam said quietly, and took his hand, squeezing it. "Tell me if you can feel Mandy in your head."
"Sure. I mean, yes. She's there."
He hadn't thought of Mandy as a little red light before the business in the tunnel with the train, but now he did. It kind of made it easier to concentrate on her.
"That's good. You can open your eyes if you want to," Mam said. "But keep thinking about Mandy. Tell me if she gets too far away for you to feel."
He could feel Mandy all the way until the caddy pulled up next to them again, though she had got a little fainter, then stronger again. They did it again, with Uncle Joe and Mandy going all the way down to Arlington Street on the far side of the public garden. He could still do it, and was getting kind of cold and bored standing there on the street.
"She can hear him fine," Uncle Joe reported, rolling down his window. "How about you, sport? You hear your sister okay?"
"Yeah," he said patiently. "I mean, I can tell where she is. Kind of. She doesn't talk in my head or anything like that."
He was glad she didn't.
He wouldn't want Mandy chattering away in his head all the time, and he didn't want her listening to his thoughts either.
He frowned at her. He hadn't actually thought of that before.
"You can't hear what I'm thinking, can you?" he demanded, shoving his face in the open window.
Mandy was riding up front now, and looked up at him, surprised. She'd been sucking her thumb, he saw. It was all wet.
"No,"
she said, kind of uncertainly. He could see she was sort of scared by this. So was he. But he figured he wouldn't let her, or Mam, know that.
"That's good,"
he said, and patted her on the head. She hated being patted on the head, and swiped at him with a ferocious snarl. He stepped back out of reach and grinned at her.
"If we have to do it again," she said to his mother, "maybe Mandy can stay with you, and I'll go with Uncle Joe."
Mam glanced uncertainly at him, then at Mandy, but seemed to get what he was really saying, and nodded, opening the door for Mandy to bounce out, relieved. Uncle Joe hummed softly to himself as they turned around, went right, and headed down past the big theatre and the Freemasons' building. Jem could see Uncle Joe's knuckles showing through his skin, though, where he was clutching the wheel.
"You nervous, sport?" Uncle Joe said as they passed the frog pond.
It was drained for the winter. It looked sort of sad.
"Ah," Jem swallowed. "Are you?"
Uncle Joe glanced at him, kind of startled, then smiled as he turned back to keep his eyes on the road.
"Yeah," he said softly, "but I think it's going to be okay. You'll take good care of your mom and Mandy, and you'll find your dad. You'll be together again."
"Yeah,"
Jem said, and swallowed again. They drove in silence for a bit, and the snow made little scratchy noises on the windshield, like salt being shaken on the glass.
"Mam and Mandy are going to be pretty cold," Jem ventured.
"Yeah, this'll be our last try today," Uncle Joe assured him. "Still got her. Mandy."
He hadn't been paying attention. He'd been thinking about the stone circles and the thing in the tunnel. And
Daddy. His stomach hurt. No, he said blankly. No, I can't feel her. The idea suddenly panicked him and he stiffened in his seat, pushing back with his feet. Drive back!
Right away, pal, Uncle Joe said,
and made a U-turn right in the middle of the street.
Gloucester Street. Can you remember that name? We need to tell your mom so she can work out the distance.
Uh-huh, Jem said. But he wasn't really listening to Uncle Joe. He was listening hard for Mandy. He'd never thought about it at all before this. Never paid any attention to whether he could sense her or not. But now it was important, and he balled up his fists and shoved one into his middle under his ribs where the hurt was. Then there she was, just as though she'd always been there, like one of his toenails or something. And he let his breath out in a gasp that made Uncle Joe look sharply at him.
You got her again?
Jem nodded, feeling inexpressible relief. Uncle Joe sighed, and his big shoulders relaxed, too.
Good, he said. Don't let go.
Brianna picked up Esmeralda, the rag doll, from the floor of the Abernathy's guest room, and tucked her carefully in next to Mandy.
4 miles?
They'd spent the morning driving round Boston in circles, and now they knew roughly how far the kids' mutual radar went. Jem could sense Mandy at a little over a mile, but she could sense him at nearly 4. Jem could sense Brianna too, but only vaguely, and only for a short distance. Mandy could sense her mother almost as far as she could detect Jem. She should write that down in the guide, she thought, but she'd spent the afternoon in frenzied arrangements, and right now the effort of finding a pencil felt like searching for the source of the Nile, or climbing Kilimanjaro.
Tomorrow.
The thought of tomorrow jolted her out of her exhausted torpor with a zap of adrenaline. Tomorrow it would start. They'd talked after the kids had gone to bed. She and Joe, with Gail listening in the corner, the whites of her eyes showing now and then, but saying not a word. It has to be Scotland, she'd explained. It's December. Ships can't sail until the springtime. If we crossed in North Carolina, we couldn't travel from the colonies before April and wouldn't get to Scotland before the summer. And putting aside the fact that I know what ocean travel in the 18th century is like, and I wouldn't do that with the children unless the alternative was being shot, I can't wait that long. She'd taken a gulp of wine and swallowed, but the knot in her throat didn't go down any more than it had with the last half dozen swallows. Anything could happen to him in 6 months. Anything. I have to find him. The Abernathys glanced at each other, and Gail's hand touched Joe gently on the knee.
Of course you do, she said. You're sure about Scotland, though. What about the people that tried to take Jem from you? Won't they be waiting if you go back?
Bree laughed, shakily, but a laugh. Another reason to go right away, she said. In the 18th century, I can stop looking over my shoulder.
You haven't seen anybody,
Joe started, frowning. But she shook her head. Not in California, and not here. But I keep watching. She'd taken a few other precautions, too, things she'd recalled from her father's brief and discreet memoir of his World War II experiences. But no need to go into those.
And you have some idea how to keep the kids safe in Scotland?
Gail was perched uneasily on the edge of her seat, as though wanting to spring up and go check on the kids. Brianna knew the feeling. She sighed and wiped a straggle of hair out of her eye.
There are 2 people, well, 3 there, that I think I can trust.
You think? Joe echoed, sounding skeptical. The only people I know I can trust are right here, she said simply, and lifted her wine glass to them. Joe looked away and cleared his throat. Then he glanced at Gail, who nodded at him.
We'll go with you, he said firmly, turning back to Bree. Gail can mind the kids. and I can make sure nobody bothers you till you're set to go."
She bit her lip to quell the rising tears. "No," she said, then cleared her own throat hard to kill the quaver in her voice, caused as much by the vision of the two doctors Abernathy strolling the streets of Inverness as by gratitude. It wasn't that there were no black people in the Highlands of Scotland, but they were sufficiently infrequent as to cause notice. "No," she repeated, and took a deep breath. "We'll go to Edinburgh to start. I can get the things we need there without attracting attention. We won't go up to the Highlands until everything is ready, and I'll only get in touch with my friends there at the last minute. There won't be time for anyone else to realize we're there before we... go through." That one word, "through," hit her like a blow in the chest, freighted as it was with the memory of a howling void that lay between now and then, between herself and the kids, and Roger. The Abernathys hadn't given up easily, or altogether. She was sure there would be another attempt at breakfast, but she had faith in her own stubbornness, and, pleading exhaustion, had escaped from their kind worries in order to be alone with her own. She was exhausted, but the bed she'd share with Mandy didn't draw her. She needed just to be alone for a bit, to decompress before sleep would come. She could hear going-to-bed noises on the floor below. Taking off her shoes, she padded silently down to the first floor, where a light had been left on in the kitchen, and another at the end of the hallway by the den, where Jem had been put to bed on the big couch. She turned to go and check on him, but her attention was diverted by a familiar metallic chunk. The kitchen had a pocket door slid half across. She stepped up to it and glanced through the opening to discover Jem standing on a chair next to the counter, reaching to pull a Pop-Tart out of the toaster. He stood up, wide-eyed at the sound of her step, held the hot pastry for a second too long, and dropped it as it burned his fingers.
"Ethan!"
"Don't say that," she told him, coming to retrieve the fallen tart. "We're about to go where people would understand it. Here, do you want some milk with that?" He hesitated for an instant, surprised, then hopped down like a toey, both feet together, and landed with a light thud on the tiled floor.
"I'll get it. You want some too?"
Suddenly nothing on earth sounded better than a hot blueberry Pop-Tart with melting white icing and a glass of cold milk. She nodded, and broke the hot tart in two, putting each half on a paper towel. "I couldn't sleep," she finally said, after they'd eaten their snack in companionable silence. He shook his head, red hair ruffled up in porcupine spikes. "Want me to read you a story?" She didn't know what made her say that. He was much too old to be read to, though he was always somewhere nearby when she read to Mandy. He gave her a jaundiced look, but then, surprisingly, nodded, and scampered up to the third floor, coming back with a new copy of Animal Nursery Tales in hand. He didn't want to lie down right away, but sat very close to her on the sofa while she read, her arm round his shoulders, and his weight growing warm and heavy against her side as his breathing slowed. "My dad used to read to me if I woke up and couldn't go back to sleep," she said softly, turning the last page. "Grandpa Frank, I mean. It was a lot like this. Everything quiet." And themselves, cosy and bonelessly content, alone together in a puddle of warm yellow light, with the night far away. She felt Jem's sleepy interest rise.
"Was he like Granda, Grandpa Frank?"
She told the kids little things about Frank Randall, not wanting him to be forgotten. But she knew he'd never be much more than a faint ghost beside the vivid warmth of their other grandfather. The grandfather they might have back. She felt a sudden small tearing in her heart, a vivid second of understanding for her mother.
"Oh, Mama."
"He was different," she said softly, her mouth brushing his bright hair.
He was a soldier, though. They had that in common. And he was a writer, a scholar, like Danny. All of them were, alike, though. They'd all take care of people. It's what a good man does.
Oh.
She could feel him falling asleep, struggling to keep a hold on consciousness. The dreams beginning to walk through his waking thoughts. She eased him down into the nest of blankets and covered him, smoothing the cowlick on the crest of his head.
Could we see him?
Jem said suddenly, his voice drowsy and soft.
Daddy?
Yes, we'll see him, she promised, making her own voice solid with confidence.
No, your daddy,
he said, his eyes half open, glazed with sleep.
If we go through the stones, could we see Grandpa Frank?
Her mouth dropped open, but she still hadn't found an answer when she heard him start to snore. Chapter 100.
Be those thy beasts?
While it was undeniably true that standing stones didn't bite, Roger thought, that didn't mean they weren't dangerous. It had taken them only a day and a half to find the stone circle. He'd made a quick sketch of standing stones on the back of his hand with a bit of charcoal to assist communication, and it had worked surprisingly well. While the scattered people they'd found had regarded them with immense curiosity, and not a few private glances accompanied by whirling motions of the forefinger beside the head, no one had found the visitors more than odd, and everyone had known where the stones were. They'd come across a tiny village, in fact, consisting of a church, a public house, a smithy, and several houses, where the last household they'd approached had even sent one of their younger sons along to guide Buck and Roger to their goal. And there they were now, a scatter of stumpy, lichened, wind-scored pillars beside a shallow lake filled with reeds. Ageless, harmless, part of the landscape. And the sight of them filled Roger with a fear that shivered as coldly over his skin as though he stood there naked to the wind.
"Can you hear them?"
Buck muttered under his breath, his own eyes fixed on the stones.
"No,"
Roger muttered back.
"Can you? I hope not."
But Buck shuddered suddenly, as though something had walked across his grave.
"Be those thy beasts?"
the boy asked, grinning at Roger. He pointed at the stones, explaining, Roger thought, the local legend that the stones were, in fact, fairy cattle, frozen in place when their drover had too much drink betaken and fell into the lake.
"Sooth,"
the boy assured them solemnly, making a cross over his heart.
"Mester Hackforth found his whip."
"When?" asked sharply.
"And where liveth Mester Hackforth?"
"A week ago, maybe 'twa," said the boy, waving a hand to indicate that the date was not important. And he would take them to Maester Hackforth if they liked to see the thing. Despite his name, Maester Hackforth proved to be a slight, light-haired young man, the village cobbler. He spoke the same impenetrable Northumbrian dialect, but with some effort and the helpful intervention of the boy, whose name, he said, was Ridley, their desire was made clear, and Hackforth obligingly fetched the fairy whip out from under his counter, laying it gingerly before them.
"Oh, Lord,"
Roger said at sight of it, and with a raised brow at Hackforth to ask permission, touched the strip carefully. A machine-woven, tight-warped strip some 3 inches wide and 2 feet long, its taut surface gleaming even in the dim light of the cobbler's shop. Part of the harness of an RAF flyer. They had the right stones, then. Careful questioning of Mr. Hackforth, though, elicited nothing else helpful. He'd found the fairy lash lying in the shallows of the lake, washing to and fro among the reeds, but had seen nothing else of note. Roger noticed, though, that Ridley twitched slightly when Mr. Hackforth said this. And after they had left the cobbler's house, he paused at the edge of the village, hand in his pocket. I thank ye, Master Ridley, he said, and pulled out a broad tuppenny piece that made the boy's face light up. Roger put it into Ridley's hand, but when the boy would have turned to go, laid his own hand on the lad's arm.
One more thing, Master Ridley, he said,
and with a glance at Buck, drew out the identity discs. Ridley jerked in Roger's grasp, his round face going pale. Buck made a small sound of satisfaction and took Ridley by his other arm.
Tell us about the man, Buck suggested pleasantly, and I might not break thy neck.
Roger shot Buck a glance of annoyance, but the threat was effective. Ridley gulped as though he'd swallowed a mushroom whole, but then began to talk. Between Ridley's dialect and his distress, the tale took some time to piece together, but at last Roger was fairly sure they had the gist of it.
Let him go, he said,
letting go of Ridley himself. He groped in his pocket and came out with another copper penny, which he offered to the boy. Ridley's face flexed between fear and outrage, but after a moment's hesitation, he snatched the penny and made off, glancing over his shoulder as he ran.
He'll tell his family, Buck observed. We'd best hurry.
We had, but not on that account. It's getting dark.
The sun was very low, a brilliant band of yellow light showing at the foot of a cold ochre sky.
Come on, we need to take the direction while we can.
So far as Roger had been able to follow Ridley's story, the strangely dressed man, some said he was a fairy, some thought him a northerner, though there was confusion as to whether this meant a Scot, a Norseman, or something else, had had the ill luck to show up at a farm 2 or 3 miles from the stones, where he'd been set upon by the inhabitants, these being an antisocial clan called Wod. The Wods had taken everything of apparent value off the man, beaten him, and tossed him into a ravine. One of the Wods had boasted of it to a drover passing through, who had mentioned the stranger in the village. The village had, of course, been interested, but not sufficiently so as to go looking for the man. When Hackforth, the cobbler, had found the peculiar strip of cloth, though, rumours had started to fly thick and fast. Excitement had reached a higher pitch this very afternoon, when one of Maester Quarton's cowmen had come into the village to have a boil lanced by Granny Racket, and revealed that a stranger with incomprehensible speech had tried to steal a pie from Mrs. Quarton's sill, and was even now held captive, whilst Maester Quarton thought what best to do with him.
What might he do?
Roger had asked. Ridley had pushed out his lips portentously and shaken his head.
Might kill un, he said. Might take un's hand off. Maester Quarton don't hold with thieving.
And that, aside from a vague direction regarding the location of the Quarton farm, was that.
This side of the wall, 2 miles west and a little south, below a ridge and along the stream, Roger said grimly, lengthening his stride. If we can find the stream before full dark.
Aye.
Buck fell in beside him as they turned toward where they left the horses.
Suppose Quarton keeps a dog?
Everybody here keeps a dog.
Oh, God.
Chapter 101. Just One Chance. There was no moon. Undeniably a good thing, but it had its drawbacks. The farmhouse and its outbuildings lay in a pocket of darkness so profound that they mightn't have known it was there, had they not seen it before the light was quite gone. They'd waited, though, for full dark, and the dousing of the dim candlelight inside the house, and then an extra half hour or so to ensure that the inhabitants, and their dogs, were well asleep. Roger was carrying the dark lantern, but with the slide still closed. Buck ran into something lying on the ground, let out a startled cry, and fell headlong over it. The something proved to be a large sleeping goose, which let out a startled honk, somewhat louder than Buck's cry, and promptly set about him with beak and thrashing wings. There was a sharp, inquiring bark in the distance.
"Hush," Roger hissed,
coming to his ancestor's aid.
You'll wake the dead, let alone them in the house.
He dropped his cloak over the goose, which shut up, and began waddling around in confusion, a mobile heap of dark cloth. Roger clapped a hand to his mouth, but couldn't help snorting through his nose.
Aye, right, Buck whispered, getting to his feet. If you think I'm getting your cloak back for you, think again.
I'll get out of it soon enough,
Roger whispered back.
He's no need of it. Meanwhile, where the devil do you think they've got him? Some place that's got a door you can bolt.
Buck rubbed his palms together, brushing off the dirt.
They'd no keep him in the house, though, would they? It's no that big.
It wasn't. You could have fitted about 16 farmhouses that size into Lallybroch, Roger thought, and felt a sudden sharp pang, thinking of Lallybroch as it was when he would own it. Buck was right, though. There couldn't be more than 2 rooms and a loft, maybe, for the kids. And given that the neighbours thought Jerry, if it was Jerry, was a foreigner at best, a thief and/or supernatural being at worst, it wasn't likely that the Quartons would be keeping him in the house.
"Did you see a barn before the light went?"
Buck whispered, changing to garlic. He had risen onto his toes, as though that might help him see above the tide of darkness, and was peering into the murk. Dark adapted as Roger's eyes now were, he could at least make out the squat shapes of the small farm buildings. Corn crib, goat shed, chicken coop, the tousled shape of a hayrick.
No,
Roger replied in the same tongue. The goose had extricated itself and gone off making disgruntled small honks. Roger bent and retrieved his cloak.
Small place. You likely haven't more than an ox or a mule for the ploughing, if that. I smell stock, though. Manure, Ken.
Kine, Buck said, heading abruptly off toward a square-built stone structure.
A cow byre. That'll have a bar to the door.
It did, and the bar was in its brackets.
I don't hear any kine inside,
Buck whispered, drawing close.
And the smell's old.
It was near on winter. Maybe they'd had to slaughter the cow, or cows. Maybe they'd driven them to market. But cow or no, there was something inside. He heard a shuffling noise, and what might have been a muffled curse.
Aye, well, there's something inside.
Roger raised the dark lantern, groping for the slide.
Get the bar, will you?
But before Buck could reach for the bar, a shout of, "Hoi!" came from inside, and something fell heavily against the door.
Help! Help me! Help!
The voice spoke English, and Buck changed back at once.
Will you, for God's sake, hush your noise?
He said to the man inside, annoyed.
You want to have them all down on us? Here then, bring the light closer,
he said to Roger, and drew the bar with a small grunt of effort. The door swung open as Buck set down the bar, and light shone out of the lantern's open slide. A slightly built young man with flyaway fair hair,
the same colour as Buck's,
Roger thought, blinked at them, dazzled by the light, then closed his eyes against it. Roger and Buck glanced at each other for an instant, then, with one accord, stepped into the byre.
He is, Roger thought. It's him. I know it's him. God, he's so young. Barely more than a boy.
Oddly, he felt no burst of dizzying excitement. It was a feeling of calm certainty, as though the world had suddenly righted itself, and everything had fallen into place. He reached out and touched the man gently on the shoulder.
What's your